Welcome to Stories from Palestine podcast. This is episode 5 of season 2. Feel free to listen back to older episodes. You can find them easily if you listen on a podcast player such as Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, or Spotify, but there are lots of others. You can download them on your phone and you have all the episodes available. At the end of this podcast, I will be sharing some extras about the podcast, let's say some footnotes that you can either listen to or skip them if you are mainly interested in today's guided tour / history class. If you prefer to read along, I know my mom does, because for a non-native English speaker, it's not always easy to follow up on all the details, then you can do that on my website, storiesfrompalestine.info. Thanks to Descript, an application that I recently discovered, I can now transcribe the full episodes and upload them to the website for your convenience. This podcast episode is the first of a trilogy that will take you from Jerusalem to Jaffa. If you are new to the podcast, my name is Crystal and I'm a Dutch woman living in Palestine with my husband and 2 children, and I'm studying the tour guide program at the Bethlehem Bible College. And I originally started this podcast as a way to practice, because due to the COVID pandemic, there haven't been any tourists for the past year, and due to all the lockdowns, it's been pretty hard to visit the sites that we're studying. So recording episodes for the podcast was my way of training myself in remembering the information and turning all that information into stories that are interesting to listen to. And it turns out that I am now the only one of all the students that is preparing for the general exam, which means it includes all the sites in the West Bank and historic Palestine, the current state of Israel. The others have all chosen for the local or West Bank category, so I am now under quite a lot of study pressure, and I decided that besides the interview episodes with inspiring Palestinians that I will keep doing, I'm going to use my time well and record more, let's say, tour guide episodes. So this is the first of a trilogy. Don't expect the second episode of this trilogy to come immediately next week. I will alter between, let's say, these monologues and the interviews. And I want to make a little disclaimer here related to the fact that we are traveling here in the Holy Land and that I am studying at the Bible College. So an important part of the history of Palestine is related to the Bible stories. And in my podcast, I am trying to balance between stories from all times and all religions. And personally, I consider myself agnostic. I believe that humans need religion, or maybe better to say, we need common stories and beliefs to have a set of values according to which we live. And I see religions as vehicles to move through this life that we have here on earth. And somebody decides to take the bike, the others take a bus, the others go by airplane. But for myself, I am interested in all religions. I learn from all of them on how to be a better person and how to develop myself and to be respectful to others and how to become a giver more than a taker. So the point of this disclaimer is to make sure that you understand where I'm coming from so that you can put the stories in the right perspective within the context of this podcast. And now I want you to sit back, close your eyes and relax, or if you're walking, maybe better not close your eyes, but imagine that you are on a bus with me leaving West Jerusalem towards the port of Jaffa. We are going to make a tour from Jerusalem to Jaffa. And I want you to imagine that we are on a bus. It's like a virtual tour. You can't see what I'm talking about, but I'm going to try and be as descriptive as possible. Now we're going to leave Jerusalem on the western side. And if you would leave the old city of Jerusalem, you would go out from the old city gate. But West Jerusalem was built only after the State of Israel was created in 1948, and therefore it doesn't have hardly any buildings that predate 1948. So leaving Jerusalem from the western side There is no city gate, but we are passing under a bridge that kind of gives you the idea and symbolizes the entrance and exit of Jerusalem in its most modern form, a bridge that was made in 2008 by a Spanish architect called Santiago Calatrava. And the bridge reminds me of the Erasmus Bridge in Rotterdam in the Netherlands, my home country. I don't know if you know it, but it is the same idea. It's a very long bridge. It's 360 meters long, and it crosses over the main road, the road that we are going to take towards Jaffa. And it connects Kiryat Moshe, a neighborhood of West Jerusalem, with the central bus station and the rest of Jerusalem towards the Old City. It is made for the tram and for foot passengers, for pedestrians, and it consists of a very high arm in the middle of steel going up 118 meters. And from the top, there are 66 strings or cords, that's why it's called the cords bridge, that are holding up the weight of the bridge. The architect himself says that this all symbolizes the harp of David. And David was the second king of the Israelites, of the Jewish people, when they were living in the land about 1,000 years before Christ. Their first king was called Saul. And now if we continue under the bridge, we will see on our left-hand side a neighborhood called Givat Shaul. And that is the first king before King David became the king. And when we talk about Givat Shaul, we have to talk about part of the history of Palestine that is very difficult and that is something we can never avoid because Palestine has been going through all these different phases of occupation, of different empires ruling the country. And the people of Palestine, the native people, they have seen them coming and going and they've been working their land. They've been trying to make a living, they've been building their families, but in 1948, that is the last big atrocity that happened, on this location there was the village of Deir Yassin, and Deir Yassin is known to many people as the place where a horrible massacre happened. Deir Yassin was a small Palestinian village of about 700 people, and the villagers had actually signed a non-aggression pact with the Zionist movement. They also knew that in the United Nations partition plan of 1947 that was giving a state to the Jewish people and a state to the Palestinian people, that they would be part of the Corpus Separatum of Jerusalem, which meant that Jerusalem and the surrounding villages would be governed by a special international regime. So the villagers of Deir Yassin would never have expected what was about to happen. On Friday, the 9th of April, 1948, about 100 Zionist militants from the Irgun and from the Sterngang came into the village. They killed at least 107 people. They paraded a lot of the men around Jerusalem before killing them. There are many accounts of women who escaped and told about rape. There's an account of a pregnant woman who was shot from a close range. And people were asking for help from the British because in that time, Palestine was still under the British rule, under the British mandate. But the British commander, Sir Gordon MacMillan, he did not want to get involved in anything that didn't directly serve the British interest and he didn't want to face the Jewish militias. Now it's important to realize that the leader of the Irgun was Menachem Begin, and the leader of the Sterngang was Yitzhak Shamir, and both of them became later prime ministers of the State of Israel. According to Begin, they had sent a truck into the village, and on a loudspeaker they had announced that people should leave the village. They had warned them, but many witnesses say that the truck had an accident and never managed to get into the village to spread the word. And also the people did not expect anything like this could happen. It was the first big massacre and it was a warning to all the Palestinian villages around because people who fled from Deir Yassin came to the villages close by and told them, run for your lives because the Zionists are coming to kill you. And that was the catalyst for many Palestinians to flee their homes, and they ended up in refugee camps in countries like Lebanon, Syria, and Jordan, but also in the West Bank and in the Gaza Strip. From Deir Yassin, there are three buildings left. The rest is completely ruined. The three buildings that are left are two houses and a school. And the school is now used as a yeshiva, a Jewish religious school. The buildings are inside a complex that is now used as a mental health center called the Kfar Shaul Mental Health Center that was established in 1951. As a revenge for the Deir Yassin massacre, 4 days later, the Arab fighters attacked a medical convoy that was on its way to Hadassah and killed 78 Jews. And here it's important to realize what was going on in that time. Palestine had been part of the Ottoman Empire for 400 years until 1917, when the Ottoman Empire fell. And from that time, Palestine was under British rule, the British Mandate. And even from before 1917, the Palestinians had started to see more and more Jewish immigrants from different parts of the world coming and immigrating to Palestine. And at some point, they started to realize that these people were not coming to live with them, but to replace them. And when they realized that, they started to organize themselves into Arab resistance. And especially the road that we're driving on now, the main road towards Jaffa, was an important road because it connected Jerusalem to Jaffa, to the seaport. So it was the road over which all the supplies to Jerusalem were being transported. And that's why a lot of the Palestinian resistance in that time happened in this area. And about 2-3 kilometers north of Deir Yassin, we are now passing by Al-Kastal. And Al-Kastal was a small village of not more than 100 people in 1948 that was named after a crusader fortress. And the crusader fortress was called the Belver or Boverium, the Good View, and it was a castle. And that's why the Palestinian village got the name Kastal, from castle. So you can see that already the crusaders in the 11th century, they recognized that this was an important strategic place. Now the small village with only about 40 people had stone houses, had about 200 dunams of land for agriculture, that's about 20 hectares or 2 square kilometers. And it was a key position from where the Arab forces were attacking convoys of the Zionist movement to prevent them from reaching Jerusalem. The leader of the Palestinians was Abdel Kader al-Husseini. And on the 3rd of April 1948, the Zionist militias attacked Al-Kastal in the Battle of Al-Kastal, or what is also called Operation Nachshon. And it's interesting that most of the operations of the Israeli forces are named after biblical figures or biblical events, just like they often call the settlements in the West Bank after biblical names. And Nachshon is, according to biblical tradition, the person who was the first one to enter into the sea when God split the water so that they could flee from the Egyptian forces. So he was a biblical hero, and this operation was named after him. It was the Palmach troops that occupied the village of Al-Kastal, but in the night, the Palestinians, under leadership of Abdel Kader al-Husseini, they came back to the village and they reconquered it. Only the next day, the Palestinian fighters realized that their leader had been captured and killed. And that is when they lost their morale. And they also did something that is very typical, I would say, for Palestinians or for Arabs in general. They all went to the funeral to pay their respect to their leader. So they all went to Al-Aqsa Mosque. And the Jewish militias took advantage when the village turned out to be empty, and they retook it, and that's how Al-Kastal came into the hands of the Zionists again, And on the lands of Al-Kastal, the settlement of Mevaseret Zion was built. A third story related to this part of the history of 1948 is the story of Lifta, a town that we will see on our left-hand side. And what is special about Lifta is that Lifta was also depopulated in 1948, just like about 530 other Palestinian villages that were attacked and its people forcibly displaced. But this is the only town in Palestine that was neither repopulated nor completely destroyed. So that means that when we pass by, we can see on our left-hand side, on the slopes of the hill, the ruins of the houses of this Palestinian village. And it was a very beautiful and rich village. The lands of Lifta were about 8.7 square kilometers in size. They used to reach up from Lifta all the way to the old city wall of Jerusalem, to the gates of Jerusalem. And about 3 square kilometers of that land was cultivated. There's an account of at least 1,500 olive trees belonging to people in the village. It was a rich village. People are talking about the women used to wear gold. People were very rich. They were highly educated. About 3,000 people lived in the village. The name Lifta derives from biblical times, when it is written that someone called Nephtoah opened a fountain here on the border of the area of Judah and Benjamin. And when you visit the ruins of Lifta village today, you can still see the spring and the basin that was built to collect the water from the spring. Orthodox Jews come there to bathe because they believe that it's biblical waters, and they believe that you should purify yourself in running water. But the water has been used for centuries by the people in Lifta to irrigate the agricultural terraces, and until today you can still see the irrigation system running down the valley. So what happened to Lifta? It was already in December 1947 that 6 people of the village were gunned down in the coffee house in the village by members of the Sterngang and Irgun, the same militias that committed the massacre in Deir Yassin. The militias kept being active in this area and kept harassing the villagers, so that some of them decided to leave. Some of them sold their lands to find a better future in other places, but many of them remained. And then in February 1948, Lifta was depopulated. People were put on trucks and brought to other parts of East Jerusalem. And the members of the Irgun and the Sterngang, they went and made holes in the roofs of the houses so that if the Palestinians would return, they would find their houses destroyed and unlivable. Of the original 450 houses in the village, 55 still stand until today. In the late 1940s and the early 1950s, the Jewish Agency settled Jewish immigrants from Yemen and Iraqi Kurdistan here. Some of them left in the 60s when they were financially compensated. About 13 families still live in the outskirts of Lifta. In 2006, a new redevelopment plan was halted by some architects, planners, environmentalists, and descendants of Lifta. They demanded that a heritage survey would be done because investors wanted to build 268 luxury units and a hotel and commercial areas on the remains of Lifta, integrating some of the ruins into their plan, but without respecting the history of the place and without respecting the fact that Palestinian refugees are still waiting for the implementation of their right to return to the villages where they fled from. Lifta can be visited, and the best way to visit it is probably with a guided tour organized by the organization Zochrot. They are specialized in taking people to the destroyed Palestinian villages and elaborating on the history of those villages, often with people who are originally from the village. And as we are heading towards the west, we are now entering into a valley, in Arabic known as Wadi es-Sarar. and in Hebrew known as Nahal Sorek. It is a beautiful valley. It is full of springs. There is also a river or a stream called the Sorek. And it is here that the Ottomans laid out the first railway from Jaffa to Jerusalem in 1892. And the railway connected Jaffa with Jerusalem through Lod and Ramle, that we will speak about in future episodes, through Beit Shemesh and Battir, and Battir we will also speak about in a future episode, and through Beit Safafa, that we talked about in episode number 3. And this valley is known for a quite well-known Bible story that any one of you who is a little bit familiar with the Bible will probably have heard about. It is the story of Samson and Delilah. So for this story, we are going back to around the 12th century before Christ. And it is the time in which the Israelites have entered into the land of Canaan and have started to conquer the land and divided it between their tribes. And they didn't have a king like the nations around them, but they had what they called judges. And these were people that they thought were inspired or appointed by God to lead them. And one of them, actually the last one before they had King Saul, was Samson. And Samson was a Nazarite. And that meant that he did not drink alcohol, that he would never touch or be in contact with a corpse, that he would spend all his life in the service of God, and that he had an amazing strength and power because he never cut his hair as a sign of his obedience to God. Now, he did have human feelings and he fell in love with a beautiful woman who was not of his tribe, who was not even of his people. She was part of what was considered the enemy. She was part of the Philistines. And the Philistines were sea people that had arrived from probably the Greek islands to the coast, and they had settled on the coast in the area that is now known as the Gaza Strip. And it was probably the Egyptian pharaohs who had made sure that these Philistines did not go more inland, but stayed in an enclave on the coast, on the Mediterranean. So Samson fell in love with Delilah, and her people told her that they would give her money if she could find out what was his strength. How could they beat him? Because he was so strong that he could easily kill tens of people at the same time. So she asked him, "What is it? What is your secret? And what is your weakness?" And at first he told her, "Well, if you tie me with 7 ropes, then I will not be able to release myself." So she tied him with 7 ropes. But when the people came to capture him, he immediately broke loose and he managed to defend himself. And then she said to him, "But Samson, why did you lie to me? Please tell me, what is it? What is your strength?" And he said, "Well, if you tie me with ropes that have never been used before, then I will not be able to release myself." And so she tried again. And again, when the people came at night to capture him, he broke loose. And then she kept asking and she kept whining and she kept pushing him to tell her the secret. And eventually, you know, man, he couldn't resist and he told her his secret. He said, "No razor has ever touched my head." So in that night, she cut his hair and he lost all his strength. And then when they came to capture him, they managed to capture him. They tortured him. They even made him blind. And if you know the end of the story, you know that what they did to him is they brought him to the temple of one of their gods and they tied him to the pillars. And he asked God for one more time, a last strength and power. And he managed to pull down the pillars and he died, but he died with all his enemies around him. And so this is, according to the biblical tradition, the place where this story happened in Nahal Sorek, or in Arabic, Wadi al-Sarar. We are about 20 minutes into this podcast episode, and if we had really been on a bus, we would have been at the location that I'm going to speak about right now. And this will be our last story, because we will take a break at the Latrun Monastery, maybe have a glass of wine there and walk through the vineyards. And then you'll have to wait for the second part of this trilogy to continue the way to Jaffa. But we are still on our way to Jaffa, and we are entering now into what is called the Ayalon Valley. And Ayalon was already the name of a Canaanite city, and it was mentioned in the 14th century before Christ, so that is about 3,400 years ago, in the Tel El Amarna letters. These letters were not written on paper as we do today. They were written on clay tablets. There were about 400 of these clay tablets found in Egypt in a place called Amarna, and that's why they are called the Amarna letters. This was correspondence between the Pharaoh of Egypt and the vassal kings in Canaan, the vassal kings of the city-states that were usually diplomatic correspondence and very often also requests for help. It is in these Amarna letters that we for the first time can read the name of Jerusalem and the name of Bethlehem, Ur-Salim and Bit-Lahmu, the house of Lahmu, which was one of the Canaanite fertility gods. It was the vassal king of Jerusalem, of Ur-Salim, his name was Abdi-Hibba, who asked the pharaoh to come and support him against the invasions by the Abiru people. And the Abiru people were lawless nomads that were continuously attacking the Canaanite city-states. So Abdi-Hibba is asking the pharaoh to come and help, and he mentions Ayalon as one of the Canaanite cities. But Ayalon is also famous from the book of Joshua of the Bible. We are still in the Holy Land, always a lot of Bible stories. It is known from the story where Joshua defeats the five Amorite kings. Now Joshua was the leader of the Israelites when they entered into the land, and their main aim was to conquer the land, and it was not their aim to make peace with the nations. One of the peoples, called the Gibeonites from Gibeon, they heard that the Israelites were very fierce people, and they decided to go and try and make a peace treaty. But they also knew they will not have a lot of chance to make a peace treaty with the Israelites because they were there to conquer the land. So they pretended that they were from a nation that was living far away, out of the borders of Canaan, and they sent a delegation to ask Joshua for a peace treaty. And Joshua thought to himself, well, that may be a good idea. If we have conquered the land, then at least we will have good connection with our neighbors. So he signed a peace treaty with them. And then he found out that the Gibeonites were living only a few kilometers away from where he was setting up his camp. He was a little bit annoyed, and he did make them into slaves, but he had made a promise to them and he did not attack them. And sometime later, they came to him, the Gibeonites, and they said, we are being attacked by a coalition of five Amorite kings. The Amorites were yet another tribe. And we want your help. And Joshua, because he was a man of his word, he gathered his army and he came and defeated the five Amorite kings. He not only defeated them, he also chased them away. And he chased them down south through the Ayalon Valley, the valley that we are driving through right now. And it's very interesting because in the Bible, in the book of Joshua, it says that, and I quote, then Joshua spoke to the Lord on the day when the Lord delivered the Amorites before the children of Israel. And he said in the sight of them, sun, stand still upon Gibeon, and you, moon, in the valley of Ayalon. And this has always been explained as the sun stood still and the moon stood still and the day was prolonged so that they could defeat the Amorites. Now, recently, researchers have found out that what probably happened in that time was a solar eclipse. And with a solar eclipse, the moon passes in between the sun and the earth and then blocks the sunlight. And that would mean that it became dark. And maybe that was helpful to Joshua to defeat the Amorite kings. Maybe they didn't realize that there were not that many of them because their army wasn't that big. Whatever happened exactly, and if this story is a true story or not, we will never know. But according to the scientists, it is so that in that exact time frame, there was a solar eclipse and it doesn't happen very often. The Valley of Ayalon in general, has seen quite a lot of battles. And this is, of course, because it's such an important connection between Jaffa and Jerusalem. But also there is a north-south route. There is the Via Maris, which is the way of the sea. This is a road that goes parallel to the coast of the Mediterranean. And then around Megiddo, it goes more towards the east, towards Damascus. That was for a long time the official postal road and trade route between Cairo and Damascus. And then there was another road that connected Gaza and Ashkelon to Ramallah. And the exact junction of these two roads was very important. And this valley has seen many battles. There is a lot of historical and archaeological evidence in this area. For example, of the Greeks fighting the Jewish revolters, of Romans building fortresses, of the Muslims setting up fortifications, of the Crusaders building fortresses, and also in later time, the Mamluks, the Ottomans, the British. For example, we are now arriving in the area called the Latrun, and this comes from the name of a Crusader fortress, and it was called in that time Le Touron des Chevaliers, the Tower of the Knights in Old French. The Crusaders built up many fortresses in the country. And we know from the episode about Beit Safafa that a lot of Palestinian villages started to exist around the existing fortresses or the remains of the fortresses of the Crusaders. This Crusader fortress that gave the name to the area Latrun was destroyed by Salah ad-Din. And it was in this area that Salah ad-Din, the leader of the Muslim army, fought Richard Lionheart during the Third Crusade, when Richard Lionheart and his army came to reconquer parts of the Jerusalem Crusader kingdom that they had lost to the Muslims. Part of this 12th century Crusader fortress can still be seen in ruins in this area. Very famous here is the Latrun Monastery. The Latrun Monastery was set up in 1890, in the late 19th century, and is a French Trappist monastery. It follows the Benedictine rules, which means they are very strict rules and a very sober life. And the Order of Trappists were set up in France in the 17th century, and they are known to support themselves with artisanal work, mainly beer brewing. But here, in the local context, they make wine because vineyards are plenty available in the area. So when you visit the Latrun Monastery, you have a beautiful view over the Ayalon Valley and you can buy delicious wine. You can also buy homemade lemon juice, homemade jam, pickled olives, olive oil, and other local and artisanal products. And I think this is a perfect place to have a break on our podcast tour, in the garden of the monastery, where they have set up picnic tables where you can chill and relax, take a lunch, and then we will continue in another episode for the second part of the tour, in which we will speak about Abu Ghosh, Al-Lud, and Ramla. I don't promise you that that will be next week, because I have some other podcast episodes and interviews lined up, but keep following Palestine Podcast for the continuation of this trilogy, From Jerusalem to Jaffa. Thank you for listening, and I hope you enjoyed this episode. Please feel free to continue your day, but if you consider yourself a super fan of the podcast, I have a few things to share with you in this section, let's say the footnotes of the podcast. First of all, I want to thank everybody who reached out to me on social media or by email to give some feedback and reviews. It's really nice to hear from you. It is a little bit lonely on the other end of the microphone if you don't know who's listening, what people are thinking about your podcast, if they're enjoying it, if they have any questions. So feel free to reach out on Instagram, on Facebook. You can write me an email. And it is easy to find all my social media accounts on podspout.app/storiesfrompalestine. And that link I will post in the show notes of the podcast so that you can easily reach out and connect to me. I wanted to share some statistics with you. On my Buzzsprout podcast hosting website, I saw that we have now listeners from 84 different countries. And let me tell you the top six of the countries that is listening. 21% of the listeners is from the United States of America. 19% is from the Netherlands, my home country. And 22% is here locally from the region. That includes the Gaza Strip, the West Bank, and historic Palestine or Israel. 8% of our listeners is from the United Kingdom. 3% is from Germany. 2% is from Canada. Another 2% is from Norway. And then we have listeners from many different countries. And I found it interesting to see that especially we have listeners from the Philippines. We have listeners from India quite a lot and from Turkey. There is quite a bunch of you listening in from Brazil and from Colombia. And I cannot mention all the 84 countries that are listening. That would take too long. But I saw that I have one listener from Myanmar, one listener in Yemen. I have a listener in Iran, in Kenya, in Algeria, in Estonia, Azerbaijan, in Namibia, in Mauritius, in Croatia and Serbia. We have in Taiwan, in Venezuela, in Argentina, and in the Republic of Lithuania, Singapore. Imagine so many different countries people are listening from. It's really amazing. I'm really happy that the podcast is putting Palestine back on the map. I also want to tell you that I have a mailing list that if you want to have a reminder every Monday about the new podcast episode, you can easily subscribe to the mailing list and you can always unsubscribe if you don't want to receive the emails anymore. And you can find the link also on my Podspout that you find in the show notes. And of course, you can also do this on the website. If you are not listening to this episode on a podcast player, I would really recommend you to look into downloading one on your phone. When you have a podcast player, it is much easier to listen to other episodes as well. You can also pause easily and do other things and then come back to the same point where you stopped the episode and listen to the rest of it. And there are many different podcast players. You can just Google podcast players and you can find the one that suits you. But very known ones are Apple Podcast, Google Podcast, Stitcher, iHeartRadio, Podchaser, and of course Spotify. And something else, one of the listeners reached out to me by email. And I'm going to read the email to you because he has a great advice for people who are trying to study the Arabic language. He says, "My name is Michael and I'm a fan and listener of your show. I just got a new book that focuses solely on spoken Palestinian Arabic. It's the first one I have come across and I thought that it might be of interest to you or some of your listeners who are trying to learn the language. The name of the book is Min Tak." M-I-N-T-A-Q-T-A-Q. You can put that in Google and see if that is available near where you are. But that is the way that I learned to speak Arabic, phonetic. I did not know how to read or write until actually only 2 years ago I really started to learn how to read. And currently my 7-year-old daughter is reading faster than I am, so it's harder to pick it up when you're older. But with this book, you can learn how to speak phonetically, because if you don't know the alphabet, you'll have to do it in Latin alphabet. And then finally, I wanted to remind you that I have a Ko-fi account, and Ko-fi is a platform on which content makers and artists can promote their work and can receive donations. And that can be as small as the amount of a cup of coffee. And that is why we always say, you can buy me a coffee. And in local context, I say, you can buy me a falafel sandwich. But to make it a little bit more interesting for you to actually go and follow my Ko-fi page, because you can also follow it, you'll get emails when I post something new. I am going to post content on the Ko-fi page that I'm not going to post anywhere else. So there'll be some photos and videos, quotes, pieces of history, posted on my Ko-fi page that you will not find on Instagram or on Facebook or on the website. If you want to follow it, go to ko-fi, ko-fi.com/storiesfrompalestine and Ko-fi is ko-fi.com/storiesfrompalestine. And you can become a follower of the Ko-fi page, and there you will find special content that you don't find anywhere else. So that's it for today. I hope you enjoyed the show. Next week, you can listen to an episode with George Zeidan from the Right to Movement.